Argument is Edmonds versus Deppish. Mr. Thies. I guess next and last. Nope. Yep.
That's it.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Bill Tice and I represent Audrey Edmonds. Ms. Edmonds was denied the right to present material evidence in her defense, and that denial was especially unfair in this case because the state got to put in all sorts of evidence to show that the parents were good parents, that they never lost their temper, thereby excluding them as the possible culprits. The state also got to put in evidence of something that was entirely extraneous to show that Audrey Edmonds was exactly the sort of person who might do something like this. And all of this was in the context of evidence, at least in terms of what really happened, was a little bit thin. Nobody claimed to have seen Ms. Edmonds hurt the child. She never acknowledged that she hurt the child. In fact, she claimed the opposite. The state's doctors.
What if the father had been prosecuted for the murder? Would you say this evidence that you wanted to get in would be admissible against him?
Yes, I would, and we cite ample authorities in our brief for that proposition, that evidence of this is evidence of guilty knowledge, and guilty knowledge is evidence of guilt itself. It's certainly not conclusive evidence of anything, but it is the type of evidence that has been admitted in courts for a long time.
In that case, if the baby had been dropped off at the babysitter's and there had been two people there and they put the baby down, propped the bottle and did things that parents do and others do, and then two people came back and found the baby in the same condition that Mrs. Edmonds said she did, then, as I understand the case as it was presented to the jury, somebody had to kill this baby with a violent shake. It was either the babysitter or the parent. Is that the way the jury got this case?
I think the jury got a little bit broader case. The jury was asked to decide, was it someone who did it within that past hour, or was it someone who could have done it within the preceding...
There were only three people who could have done it.
18 hours. It was either the two parents earlier that morning or even the next day, or it was Miss Edmonds that morning.
But there's no way that the jury could have said, they don't think there's proof that either one of them did it.
Well, if the jury had been presented with the case of two people being at the house that morning, I think they would have had the same mystery, but maybe writ a little larger.
It would have reflected back to something happened before the baby got there.
Right. Or it could have been one of the two people who were in the house. And once again, if you present...
I'm not trying to make a new case. I'm trying to follow up. Judge Posner said, would there be sufficient proof that the father did it if there was absolute proof that the babysitter didn't?
If there was absolute proof that the babysitter...
Two people were there, I'm making a hypothetical,
right.
and the baby was dropped off. If everything that Ms. Edmonds said was true, in other words, she came back, found the baby limp, didn't do anything other than prop the bottle, would there be proof to convict, I guess, the father?
There would certainly be enough evidence to sustain a guilty verdict against him under the Jackson versus Virginia standard. You know, he, of course, would be arguing the babysitter could have done it, and the state would be arguing, well, we've got a second witness who says he or she never saw her do anything wrong, and we've got this evidence that you acted very peculiarly when you were confronted with what happened, and that would be the thrust of the state's case.
Is there psychological evidence either presented here or existing elsewhere about how people react in the situation of these parents? How do we know that there was anything unusual about the father's reaction?
There was no expert testimony that was presented, and that was one of the things that the trial judge...
Is there literature on this, on how people react in these situations?
There's certainly no literature in the record, and I have to confess that I haven't gone out and tried to find any.
So
on my own, I don't know.
What makes you confident that that this is meaningful evidence?
Well, at the risk of personalizing it too much, I think that I have an idea based on my experiences in life how I would react and how other people would
all act. Other people would react?
No, absolutely not.
What percentage would react the way you would react?
I have no idea, and I
suppose it's 50% would react that way.
It would still be
50% would react like the father here.
And that was
be very good evidence, would it?
It would be good evidence because it would shed light on what happened. It would give the
How
jury.
How would it? I mean, suppose that there's a psychological literature and it says, well, in these situations, looking just at the father for a moment, some men, you know, they become hysterical, they cry and so on. Others become very silent. Suppose that was, you know, that was what was the opinion of experts on how men react in a situation of this sort. Then would this evidence be worth anything?
Yeah, yes, it would, because to be admissible evidence, to be material evidence against Valenzuela, you don't have to show that, you know, in more than 50% of the cases it would point to a particular conclusion.
You would be trying to establish reasonable doubt, I guess.
Right.
Because obviously, when I asked the earlier question, there may not be enough to convict the father, but there may be enough to put reasonable doubt on a jury to say it's beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's right.
She did it based on her own demeanor, her own actions in the past, and that sort of thing.
Right. The hypothetical jury could say, you know, we've heard Audrey Edmonds say she didn't do it, but we're not prepared to convict the father because we don't like her demeanor, or we don't think that his reaction is all that unusual. And that's really the burden of these numerous cases that have allowed demeanor evidence, that, you know, we don't know that this is absolute conclusive evidence of guilt, but we think that it's something that the jury should be allowed to consider, and it is of probative force. And in
what
this,
if it turned out that in a situation like this, 40% of men would react hysterically, and the other 60% would react like the father here. Would you still say it was pertinent evidence, you know, probative evidence?
I would, in light of the reasonable doubt standard that's applied. It would give the jury some basis, some reasonable basis, for saying we think that this lady is not guilty of the crime. I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Pace. Mr. O'Brien?
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, Daniel O'Brien, appears on behalf of the respondent, Warden Deppich. It is our position that Ms. Edmonds can only prevail if this Court is willing to agree with her position that the trial judge acted unreasonably in excluding evidence of the parent's demeanor in the hospital hours after the child was injured and while the child was still alive, fighting for her life, that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals acted unreasonably in deferring to that trial judge's thorough exercise of discretion before, during, and after the trial, and that the district court, Judge Adelman, acted unreasonably and otherwise erred in affirming the reasonableness of the state court's rulings.
No, we don't review the district judge for reasonableness.
No, you actually review it de novo, and so actually you would have to conclude that the judge erred in concluding that the state courts acted reasonably. And I just think that the only unreasonable position here is that of the petitioner arguing that all three of these courts acted improperly in reviewing this decision to exclude this evidence. The one word that comes through all of this is that it comes to my mind is the word speculation. It is pure speculation as to what this conduct means. And I think Judge Moser hit the nail on the head when he referred to this. It's really just not proving much, and I would strongly urge this court to review Judge Moser's decision on post-conviction review which is at Exhibit D in the answer, where he thoroughly discusses what was and what was not important in this case, what was significant and what was not significant in this case. The fact of the matter is this father showed all sorts of emotion at the hospital.
Well, what do you think was significant in the case?
I think the most crucial evidence here is not anyone's demeanor, although the defendant or the petitioner's demeanor on the witness stand is quite significant. She was severely damaged on cross-examination, but the most crucial evidence is the medical evidence. Here was a child who, it is undisputed, suffered injuries the equivalent of a fall from a two-story window or injuries sustained in a severe auto accident, described by all the experts as tremendously severe, big-time injuries, I think was one quote, and yet Ms. Edmonds said at 7:30 when that child arrived at her house, the kid was fine, or at least the kid was no different than any other day when she'd appear crying because her mother was leaving and she was cranky and wouldn't take her bottle. And all of a sudden, 40 minutes later, we have a lifeless, comatose, non-breathing child. I think a rational jury would look at that and say, these injuries were not sustained before they arrived at Ms. Edmonds' house. They were sustained thereafter. And the medical evidence firmly supports that.
You had a lot of medical evidence. I guess, how many doctors did testify for the state?
I believe... There were there's something like nine doctors in all. I don't know. I think
most of them testified for the state.
Yeah, there was at least one who testified for the
petition. Did any of those doctors say this injury could not have occurred from 6 to 12 hours before she was actually found or whatever you want to call it?
I can't pinpoint the specific doctor. I believe there were at least one or two who said it's highly unlikely that it would have occurred.
But others said it could have, right?
It could have. But that's a little misleading. The fact that, the window was broader than what actually happened. The fact is, well, for example, let's assume that Ms. Edmonds did cause the injuries at 8 a.m. This child did not die until 7:30 p.m. that night. So we're almost 12 hours into the future before the child actually dies. So sure, the injuries could have been inflicted hours before.
On a machine at any of that time?
Yes, I believe that there were life support mechanisms introduced.
That could impact.
But the fact is, while in theory these injuries could have been inflicted earlier, the evidence, as adduced at trial, shows that it's highly unlikely and really unreasonable to conclude otherwise, because everyone agrees, the two parents, the independent witness, Mr. Henning, who was at the daycare center, and most importantly, Ms. Edmonds herself, in her testimony at trial, all agreed that there was really nothing out of the ordinary in this child when she arrived at 7:30 that morning, and suddenly, a little over an hour later, this child is virtually dead. Now, yes, it's conceivable that these injuries might have been caused earlier, but it's highly unlikely. Moreover, regardless of when these injuries were caused, how Mr. Beard acted at the hospital at 5:30 p.m. that day by being withdrawn or, I believe, under a lot of stress with another witness's comments, how that proves or disproves his guilt is really beyond my imagination, other than to do as the petitioner invites us all to do, is speculate. Well, the trial judge refused to speculate. The trial judge wanted proof of why this is material, why this is probative, and Ms. Edmonds' attorney could only come up with speculation that it might be.
Counsel, isn't it true that judges take into consideration during a trial when a witness is very nervous and is perspiring or is moving his hands or just displaying nervousness? Isn't that an indication frequently of guilt?
I guess it depends on the way. I mean, you're talking about a defendant.
Or untruthfulness?
It certainly is, and actually that occurred in this case, as Judge Moser detailed. Ms. Edmonds
So conversely, wouldn't how a person acts immediately after the death or 4 or 5 hours after? What would be wrong with taking that into consideration?
Well, as Judge Moser pointed out here, and if you look at the offer of proof, it's set forth in the state's brief in the Court of Appeals at pages 37 and 38, I believe it's Exhibit F, this would have resulted in a mini-trial involving some 7 or 8 additional witnesses on how these parents acted at the hospital hours after the injury. And Ms. Edmonds would offer this proof that, he was stressed out, he was withdrawn. The state had several witnesses who said, no, he was very upset, he was crying, he and his wife were crying. I guess if I were one of guilty knowledge, I think I would try to act as distraught as possible to cover up my guilt. I don't know that I would betray my guilt by being...
I'm talking about allowing it in evidence, whatever it may be, is the question, isn't it?
Well, no, actually the question really for this court is whether it was unreasonable for the trial judge not to allow it. Under Morgan v. Kroenke and the U.S. Supreme Court precedent...
It's a question of the conduct, not...
Were the trial judge acting in the first instance, sure, you could reasonably disagree with Judge Moser's ruling, but you are not. You are appellate judges... federal appellate judge was reviewing a habeas corpus petition in which the only issue is whether the state courts acted unreasonably in applying Sixth Amendment jurisprudence. And we insist that Judge Moser acted reasonably, even if another judge could act just as reasonably in allowing the evidence in. Judge Moser was concerned that this would mislead and confuse the jury and cause undue delay, waste of time by bringing in all kinds of witnesses describing just exactly how these people acted in the hours after the incident. And this court simply cannot say that it was unreasonable. It seems to me that it was unreasonable for this judge to say that this has such limited probative value that it should not be admitted.
I have not read Judge Moser's opinion, or whatever. What did he call it, post-conviction? What was it?
Yeah, it was the decision on post-conviction motions. He made a ruling before trial, and then on reconsideration at trial to exclude this evidence, and then he elaborated.
Okay, I haven't seen that, but apparently you say that's enlightening.
I believe that it is.
Okay,
I believe
two questions, then, and focusing on that. Number one, you mentioned earlier she was torn apart on cross-examination. Is that mean her demeanor broke down, that she... was flustered, that she
again,
was conflicting.
I believe Judge Moser addresses that, and it's all of that. It's she.
Well, that's the other question. It does go into that.
It does go into that. Her demeanor was questionable. She. I think one conclusion was that she really tailored her testimony to fit the medical reports because she gave police statements that were inconsistent with the medical reports with regard to the appearance of the child when the child arrived and that sort of thing. And I think Judge Moser details that quite well.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Thies, how much time do you have?
2 minutes. Very briefly, counsel complains that had this evidence been introduced, there would have been more witnesses called. But I think that's really the point of, or one of the points of our presentation, is that the court allowed the state to call a number of witnesses, a handful of witnesses, whose only testimony, and this was kind of on the borderline of relevant testimony, but their only testimony was that these were good and wonderful parents. So we have a situation where the state is allowed to present something that is of real marginal relevance.
Well, you could have presented counter evidence to that.
And we tried to.
Well, there's a difference between evidence about their demeanor in this shocking situation and whether previously they had given signs of hostility or unfitness as parents. How many witnesses did you want to call about their demeanor?
We offered 3 witnesses about their demeanor. It was a police officer, a chaplain at the hospital, and the helicopter pilot. And the state says they would have liked to have called additional witnesses had we called them under Chambers versus Mississippi.
6 more witnesses.
Well, they say that.
But the judge has to control the trial, doesn't he?
The judge has to control the...
How many witnesses testified altogether?
It was considerable. I'd say there were at least 9 medical doctors at the state.
How long was the trial?
The trial was about 7 trial days. And the other point I'd like to touch on in the brief time is that the state...
See, I'd be much more comfortable if you had presented or tendered or offered evidence that there's some kind of consensus in the relevant psychological community about standard reactions to this kind of disaster. Now, a lot of people do, in fact, lose a young child, you know, crib death or what have you, meningitis. So I would think, you know, and these hospitals are crawling with social workers, you know, to deal with grief of relatives. I would think there'd be some body of expert opinion as to whether these people were really acting abnormally. I mean, what a helicopter pilot says,
The one who comes closest, although it's not the sort of scientific study you have in mind, is the chaplain who said, a big component of my job is dealing with people in traumatic, grief-inducing situations, and these people did not act normal.
Did not act normal.
They were very guarded. The husband's reactions especially were inappropriate and non-standard. But it's not a scientific study. I grant you that. Thank you.
Was any effort made to qualify the chaplain as an expert? That's what you're saying. This is his job, so couldn't he have been qualified as an expert witness?
There was an offer of proof of his testimony, which includes the representations I've just made to the court. I can't say to the court that there was some specific request that the chaplain not only be allowed to testify, but testify as an expert witness. But the brunt of his testimony, or part of his testimony, was a statement based on his expertise.
But I assume he's also an occurrence witness of observing what they did in reaction to this specific thing.
Right. He was going to give his observations.
Okay, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you?
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you for your excellent efforts on behalf of you.
Thank you.
And thank you also to Mr. O'Brien. So the court will stand in recess.